Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do so many members of the military come home with brain damage? Between 2001 and 2014, the U.S. Department of Defense recorded 230,000 soldiers and vets diagnosed with some form of mild traumatic brain injury and the troubling cognitive and emotional symptoms that go with it. That number includes some who found themselves in the range of blast events but did not appear to be physically injured by them at the time. And as my guest will tell us, scientists are working to understand the physics of how blast force affects brain and body tissues in hopes of preventing the kind of lasting harm reported by soldiers as far back as World War I. Journalist Caroline Alexander's article in the February issue of National Geographic magazine is called The Invisible War on the Brain. Caroline, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me.
You open the piece by describing your experience inside a bunker used to shield soldiers who are testing explosives. You were safe from debris, but you did feel what soldiers call the thump. Tell us about that.
It was extraordinary. I had been told beforehand that this thump is the hallmark of a blast event. And people said to me, you know, you can be any number. I quote one in the story, but any number of people have said to me, wherever you are, you feel that thump. And in this concrete bunker, which is protective, we all, you know, we had our fingers jammed in our ears on the one hand, and then we're watching this remotely on a screen, but you do feel that bump, that thump, and it is chilling and very attention-getting and is, I think, a very dramatic way to sort of call attention to the fact that something goes on, even if you can't see it, which seems to have been the case with this mysterious hidden ailment of the brain.
And it seems like the thump is different from any other kind of, you know, it's different from crashing into something. It's like it sort of takes your body and rattles it, maybe the wrong word. Can you tell us a little bit about what it actually feels like?
It's my mild thump would be as if somebody took a fist and, let's say, I had a lot of protective gear on, a lot of cushioning, and then they thump me right over the chest. It's not even painful. It's just a sensation. However, other people ambushed with real events, as opposed to my sort of very micro event, have described it. One veteran interviewed said that it was like being kicked by a horse, only the hoof felt like it covered his whole body. Mm. Other people have described it as a sensation. One whom I quote in the story said it was like the explosion from distant hills, by the way. He said it felt like it lifted my innards and put them back down again. And it's just this mysterious force that comes through the air and then it is upon you. And what we're all trying to figure out now is what internal injury it does. It does very obvious external injury when limbs are torn off and other dreadful, very evident wounds. But what we're focused on now is the mystery of what it does inside the human brain.
There are soldiers called breachers whose job it is to set explosives. And it turns out that they have higher than average incidence of neurological problems compared to their comrades doing other jobs.
Yes. And this became almost the breachers became, if you will, the canaries in the mine shaft. For very many years, let's just talk in the modern era, from the wars in first war campaigns in Iraq, there was this sort of mystery affliction that was being reported in very muddled ways that appeared to be like PTSD, or maybe was PTSD, but also appeared to be something very different. And as the years went on, people started talking about traumatic brain injury. But was this really a brain injury, or was this just the stress of war manifesting many of the same symptoms? And what the breacher injury study focused on was that when there were a lot of anecdotes, just sort of, I suppose, word of mouth reports that these guys who set explosives in a very controlled manner, they're professionals and they're doing it offensively. They're not being ambushed. These are guys like the Navy SEAL team that went in and got bin Laden. They blast entry into places for reasons of, you know, getting quick access, that they should be getting these neurological symptoms was very, very enlightening. And in 2008, a study was published called the Breacher Injury Study that sort of sharply focused attention on the real neurological effects, because these guys were clearly not PTSD candidates. So it indicated something neurologically was going on.
How do the symptoms of repeated mild traumatic brain injury, or the symptoms that these breachers are experiencing, compare with the ones that are used to sort of diagnose, to signify PTSD?
Well, this is where it gets very troubling. The list, first of all, is very long. So it includes things. Headache is chronic headache is one of the main indicators. A ringing in the ears is another. Inability to sleep is another. And then you get into things that are even more, I'd say, physiological, such as motor disorders, balance disorders, cognitive disorders, mood changes. So you can see there's a whole spectrum of conditions and complaints. And some of these are the kinds of things that on a bad day, I think any one of us might monitor in ourself, or it might be a symptom that kind of nags along, or you had a bad week, or you had a stressful event and wouldn't maybe pay too much attention to. And so the sort of insidious nature of the symptoms in the so-called mild traumatic brain injury have very marked overlap with the symptoms of PTSD. And that has muddled diagnosis and even identification of the condition from the very outset of this campaign.
I was fascinated to read that as far back as World War I, there were people who said, who noticed that there must be some kind of link between exposure to blast incidents and some of these symptoms. But then even at that point, there were people who said, no, this is simply, you know, what they called at the time shell shock is really a psychological injury rather than a physiological one.
This is, to me, riveting, darkly riveting. I became interested in the modern phenomena of traumatic brain injury through work that I had done more in a kind of historical aspect on World War I and shell shock in particular. I had written on shell shock. I had studied some archives on shell shock, which are very difficult to – there aren't many that survived the war. And in reading some of these medical charts, you know, you have the going back 100 years symptoms of dreams that are described by these World War I era soldiers, and get to know their conditions very, very intimately. And so I had been immersed in that kind of material and then was reading the, you know, daily news, as it were, and seeing the same thing playing out again. And what is, I think that this is the historical precedent is very much worth paying attention to. First of all, it's from history that we get some indication of what the longitudinal diagnosis of the modern TBI victims might look like. In other words, right now in modern history, that we're still trying to come to terms with this condition. It's very hard to project what fate may or may not await soldiers of today, 10, 20, 30, 40 years out. The data from World War I is at least as imperfect as that data is instructive and indicates that the condition doesn't just vanish. It lingers on and on for decades and even until death. So I think that in this case, it is very important to pay attention to what this 100-year-old, you know, a whole other age away, might have to tell us about as we move forward.
It certainly would have implications for the planning we do for ongoing health care for these veterans.
Absolutely. One of the things that I find very chilling about the shell shock incident is, first of all, that absolutely was the signature condition of the First World War, and there were vast numbers of soldiers from every side of the Atlantic and every nation who were afflicted. And yet at the end of the war, they were more or less forgotten. And certainly when, you know, even in my lifetime growing up, for my young adulthood, there would have been soldiers of the Great War languishing somewhere with shell shock, and I certainly never thought about them, and I don't think many people did. They kind of dissolved into history. And I think we have to be very careful that that doesn't occur with the current campaigns. The numbers are not remotely as large as they were for the other war. And so one could easily imagine, looking forward 10, 20 years from now, that this, you know, condition had kind of just died and gone away. So I think it's very important that the mechanisms of access to the VA system are put in place, that it be fluid enough that as our knowledge of this condition evolves, as our diagnostic means and tools evolve, and as treatments evolve, that a person should be able to walk into that system at any point in his or her life, whether it's decades down the line and suddenly something new and concerning suddenly appears. I think this has to be a very fluid, ongoing process.
My guest is journalist Caroline Alexander. Her article, The Invisible War on the Brain, appears in the February issue of National Geographic magazine. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes, and you can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can learn to draw and paint, how to speak French, or plan for your retirement. Courses start each week through spring. Registration and information is at smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Caroline Alexander, author of The Invisible War on the Brain, an article that will appear in the February issue of National Geographic magazine. If you want to join this conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. Caroline, what exactly happens when a bomb goes off? What physical forces allow it to potentially do so much damage?
Well, first of all, I'm going to quote a top blast physicist who said to me, essentially, it's magic. What happens is you have an instantaneous combustion of some chemical that has typically, in the case we're talking about here, mostly IEDs, probably being stashed in a shell. And that combustion releases a supersonic field of rapidly expanding energy and gas, which results in very high overpressurization. So the first sort of, and all this is happening, you know, you can parse out stages, but for the average human being, we're talking about really instantaneous. They're stages, but they would appear to us mere mortals as sort of instantaneous activities or events. So that's sort of stage one. And that pressure wave is on the person or object and sort of envelops them. And then there's a rapid fall off in that pressure. And into that vacuum that has been created comes this flood of supersonic wind, which is the blast wind, which is what would knock you off your feet or throw vehicles in the air, and is itself damaging in that it not only is this a force upon you, sort of second force upon you, but some people point out that there's no such thing as a pure blast injury. That's overstating it, but the truth is that most people who have encountered blast have often encountered some other injury, and that other injury typically comes from the blast wind that might either hurl them or hurl something upon them. And so this further sort of muddies any kind of diagnosis.
So explain back blast. Is that the wind that you're talking about, this secondary effect?
No, the back blast is refraction or reflection. So you picture there's the wind, which is the kind of wind behind that floods into this vacuum. But so that's just the pure blast. Let's imagine that you're standing in a wide open field and there are no objects around, and that the blast is detonated at sufficient height that it's not going to reflect off the ground. So the phenomena I've just described is what you would have. You'd have this sort of shock front and a blast wave behind it. However, in real life, in field, usually that blast, that shock wave encounters some object, and it's either a human being or it's a roadside or it's a wall or it's a vehicle, and it reflects. Part of the wave is transmitted through the object, part is absorbed by it, but part of it is refracted. And I was astounded to learn, and again, I mean, this was like being almost taken into high wizardry, or when these blast physicists start talking about what this force can do, you just can't, you never have imagined it. And even they, by the way, are discovering out some of its new properties and realizing how little understood it is. But one of the things that astounded me was I was told that the reflected blast from Hiroshima was more powerful than the actual primary detonation, which is to say the detonation goes off in the air, the force comes down to the ground, and it reflects off the ground at a higher higher magnitude than the original explosion. So this has enormous consequences for trying to deal with this, with blast phenomena, even when you're the person who sets it off, as it were, even when you're the person who's using setting controlled explosions. So the studies that I observed, the one that you described where I felt my own little thud, those were being what I observed was a group of guys essentially blowing up small rooms that they had constructed in a kind of remote area with pressure gauges set all around to try and figure out how that blast wave ricocheted around a room. And it discovered, for example, that the worst place you can go is in the corner of a room, which is possibly counterintuitive. That's where you might think you would be protected. It also had discovered that back blast, this reflected blast, because of the nature of how blast sort of envelops a person, it can get inside their helmet. And so a helmet can actually be more damaging than not having a helmet, depending upon the circumstances, because the pressure goes up inside the helmet and comes back harder on your head, so you get a kind of double whammy. What makes blast so difficult to model and predict and control is that each event is unique. It's shaped by not just the magnitude of the actual explosion. It's shaped not just by the type of chemical that might have been used, but it's shaped by whatever the landscape around is, or the if it's an interior, a dwelling. I was said, whether that room has wall studs, where the windows are, whether it has furniture in it. All these kinds of things would affect how the blast works.
And if you, as you say, the force of this blast, the effects of it, the energy can get sort of between a helmet and a human head. It would stand to reason that it could also get between a skull and a human brain.
This is what we don't understand. I think we're on the cusp of understanding. So I'm going to sort of give you the answer as I think we sort of would have the cards on the table right now, and then sort of jump ahead to where some of the one particular new study is pointing. There right now have been a range of tests of different theories of how blast infiltrates the brain and how it affects the brain. And these range from theories that because the brain is so semi-liquid, possibly it's something to do with the way that the shock dissipates through through water. Is it something to do with the fact that the skull itself, which can be flexed, is flexed and squeezes the brain? Is it simply that you've got orifices in your skull and the pressure gets into it? Is it, and this to me is particularly intriguing, and I think increasingly coming into focus, are we being naive in targeting our studies only on the head? Blast affects the whole body. That telltale thump on the chest, is that telling us something? Is what happens in the brain simply the effect of this huge force hitting your thorax or chest and transferring itself into your vasculature, which would have result in a surge in the pressure in your vasculature, which would culminate in the brain. So these are the theories, and there's no one of those that has been proven. All are being actively tested and investigated, and all are being actively investigated, you know, by sort of very high-end studies. They're not sort of wild-card studies. I think in the course of doing this story, if you had, you know, if we'd gone to press, say, 6 months ago, I would have given you one answer. The fact that it was so protracted enabled us to report in this story on a very exciting new possibility, which I think has all the potential of actually being correct. We don't have the details of it yet, but the scientist who was working on it just indicated that from close tissue studies that he has been able to do on actual brains, autopsied brains of veterans diagnosed before their death with TBI, traumatic brain injury, that he is positive that what he's seeing is a unique injury. In other words, if he is correct, that would at least clarify a lot. It would at least tell us that this is not the same as concussion. It's not the same as what NFL players get. It's not the same as injuries you get in a car accident, that it is, in fact, something unique to blast. And that in itself has been a very contentious issue up until this time.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Joey on the line in Denton. Hi, Joey.
Hi. I was just wanting to comment on the kind of the life expectancy of a lot of these men and women after the fact. It just kind of seems like it just shrinks their life expectancy so much after, you know, a mere 3 to 5 years of service. My brother was in Special Forces, served in the mid-2000s. Was downrange numerous times in Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, more concussive blasts than he can really even remember. Now he suffers from Pick's disease, multiple seizures. His wife is now his caregiver, trained by the military. And it's completely and utterly changed their life. It's just something that, you know, he can't even almost comprehend how different his life is from, you know, 8 years ago to now. He's definitely happy. He's not, you know, disgruntled so much anymore, but I mean, definitely just suffering from the numerous blasts that he did, with PTSD. It's a different thing. It's a different person now, you know, and I just kind of wanted to say that, I mean, for the 3 to 5 years that they kind of get out of these soldiers, it shrinks their life expectancy exponentially. And that's kind of what I was wanting to say.
Joey, I'm so sorry to hear about your brother's injury, but thank you so much for your call. Is there anything, Caroline, that you want to respond to in that?
Yes. I mean, I think my brother-in-law actually took his life as a result of this. So when you say shrinking life expectancy, it most certainly does. And one of the things that people are investigating is that some of these so-called psychological aspects, you know, the emotions are rooted in the brain and in brain functions. And so this chilling overlap between PTSD and TBI, we use those terms very glibly, but when you start breaking it down, what we're talking about are emotional states that have their origin in brain functions. This is true even to some extent of PTSD, which we still regard as a more psychological affliction, but is most certainly the case with TBI. So if you have a part of your brain, the frontal lobe, which is, you know, which has evolved to deal with so-called executive functions, with acts of control, with judgment calls, with appropriate behavior, all this list of mechanisms that that we take for granted, and that is injured, it doesn't function normally anymore. And from the outside, that looks like an emotional problem or an array of emotional problems, but in fact, it is a physiological injury. And we do not have any means at the moment, at this time, not only do we not have any means of treating this physiological injury, we actually don't have any means of securely diagnosing it. And what is stunning to me is that the same method of diagnosis is being used as it was to diagnose shell shock soldiers in World War I, which is to say it's clinical. You fill out a questionnaire. Questionnaire is often computerized today. But basically, it's the same kind of protocol, which is that you're asked almost to self-diagnose or self-express what you're feeling. Many young men in particular, I say men because their numbers are much greater, and also there has been a kind of culture of brushing off injuries. If you've been out with, you know, on a patrol and you witnessed a buddy of yours who was either killed or had his, you know, lost a limb, are you really going to complain about your headache? Mm. And so a lot of these symptoms are dreadfully masked. Until there's, you know, and we're not, people are traveling blind. And in terms of knowing how aggressive to be about concerns that might appear to just be, you know, just kind of inconvenience after a long and stressful tour. You can't sleep. Well, is that because just you've got a lot on your mind because you've been under a lot of stress, or is it actually symptomatic of something deeper? And I couldn't agree more. I mean, the short years of service, and then a lifetime of payment for that, it's a reality. And so the only way we can make the only responsible thing to do is to make sure that the mechanism of managing this lifetime ahead is done in the most intelligent way. And the easiest, most accessible way possible. And this is why I stress the flexibility of an ongoing program. We're traveling so blind, there's got to be a lot more information that will be coming, and the veterans have got to be able to keep abreast of that.
My guest is journalist Caroline Alexander. We're talking about her article, The Invisible War on the Brain, in the February issue of National Geographic magazine. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can learn to draw and paint, how to speak French, or plan for your retirement. Courses start each week through spring. Registration and information is at smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Caroline Alexander, author of The Invisible War on the Brain, an article that appears in the February issue of National Geographic magazine. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. So, Caroline, you said there's no good way to treat these injuries at this point. There's no way to securely diagnose them without an autopsy, which of course doesn't help people who are alive and walking around. What about equipment, protective gear that might help prevent or mitigate these injuries?
Well, a lot has been attempted. There have been lots of studies, both computer modeling of how blast might work around, you know, a helmet or body armor or so forth, and then bizarre tests in fields, you know, with mannequins or kind of heads of dummies, just to see, you know, what happens. The problem is that until you know sort of what you're modeling for, it's very difficult to see quite what to test for. If we knew that it was, you know, that the damage was caused, let's say, for the sake of argument, by the flexing of the skull, which squeezes the brain, obviously you would focus very, you know, very sternly upon helmet specifications and how you might make them padded and protective. Although something that could prevent that would also be very, very cumbersome. There had been a theory that possibly the damage is caused by the blast wind that snaps the head sort of back and forth in a way that would be typical of whiplash. And if that were the case, then you would find some method to keep the head from flopping back and forth. The only problem, again, is that, you know, soldiers face many threats, not just from IEDs, and they have to be able to be to maneuver. And the kind of, you know, preventative strategies that might prevent blast from doing something might also inhibit their free movement that, you know, they would need to be safe in other situations. So a lot of study has been gone on constructively. One can say that it appears that there's some kind of helmet padding that might prevent the so-called underwash, this ability of the blast wave and pressure to get underneath the helmet. But and that would be a sensible measure. But until you know what the cause is, it's very hard to move forward in a way that you can be confident is constructive. I'm still intrigued, and I have a kind of my if I had to bet, if somebody said to me, just, you know, you stand and declare, what do you think it is? At this moment, I tend to think, have a lot of faith in this belief that it's the full body contact, the full body exposure. There were some remarkable studies that were done with mice, which they exposed to shock tube blast, and their heads were protected with sort of plexiglass barrier, and it made no difference. Their brains still lit up with inflammation. But when their chests were covered with the same kind of plexiglass covering, there was no inflammation in the brain. So there's a strategy. If that proved to be the case, then one would say, aha, you know, now we need really, really solid protective body armor. So there are many, many strategies being tried. But again, until we know what the cause is, it's just a little bit cumbersome.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Jeff on the line in Decatur. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, ma'am.
Hi.
Hey, first of all, great show, Chris, and to the author. Thank you for studying this topic. I'm an Iraq and Afghanistan vet, and I'm very interested myself. My question, I had read a couple years ago an article suggesting that there are neurological disorders caused by non-concussion related environmental factors in Iraq and Afghanistan. Basically, the environment, things in the dust, things in the air had adverse effects on the neurological systems of people not native to the Middle East. And that was about all I'd heard about that. And I have a friend who's a fellow Iraq vet, and he was recently diagnosed with multiple sclerosis and did get a service-connected disability discharge with it. So I was wondering if there's any evidence or anything suggesting that there are neurological disorders that vets are facing from events or things other than blasts. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your call, Jeff.
Thank you. No, it's a sort of yes and no answer. There's so, you know, in the blast event, there's the sort of primary and secondary effects, as I described, with the blast wave and then the blast wind. But then after that, you do get, you know, release of chemicals, most certainly kind of dust blown up in the air, as well as shrapnel and fire and heat and everything else going on all around. It is clear, I think that neurologists now would declare that there is something specific that blast pressure, force, shockwave does. And that is what their mission is to try and unlock, and which I think we're close to understanding. At the same time, that doesn't preclude the very real possibility that other complicating factors are going on. And as you say, one of them possibly could be heat and chemicals. I spoke to a guy, one of the sort of top rehabilitative professionals at Harvard, who said, you know, you look at the situation and you have people, they're in 119 degree, 120 degree heat, they're dehydrated, they're under inordinate stress, they're over-caffeinated. and you've got all this other stuff going on, the body just isn't set up to be able to accommodate maybe all of that kind of all of those kinds of challenges. So I don't think that the brain damage would come from the from those factors. I think the brain damage comes from whatever it is that this blast wave does. But certainly when one's looking at a holistic approach of treatment, that has to be paid attention to. Now, I'm fascinated. There has been no, so far, there has been no convenient overlap of symptoms that allow us to bear down and say, aha, here's a pattern of MS, for example. But at the same time, at this moment of speaking, the most effective, promising technique of diagnosis in a living person's brain is a technique that is used to diagnose multiple sclerosis, believe it or not. And what it has shown in some of the soldiers, living soldiers diagnosed with TBI, is that the myelin, which is the white fatty sheathing, the insulation, if you will, of your axonal cable, that's the signaling, long signaling network in your brain, is very, very thin in remarkably thin in this very small study, pioneering study just published last year of TBI injured vets. So that is how MS is diagnosed, or one of the ways it's diagnosed. So it is possible that maybe this is having some kind of effect. On the other hand, it can. We never know what people's baseline is, and maybe the people who get injured are people who are already susceptible and have thinner shielding of their thinner myelin shielding on, you know, in their brains than other people. There's just every aspect of this is mysterious.
You report that as recently as 2008, there were shouting matches within the Pentagon as to whether blast injury, neurological injury, was even a thing. Are they taking it seriously now?
They're taking it deadly seriously now. What happened in the early years of the war, I mean, I think you can safely say that from up until 2008, there was a very conflicted very divided opinion as to how real this so-called, you know, TBI phenomena was. Was it just another form of TB of PTSD? And there was a very high-placed article actually published in the New England Journal of Medicine out of Walter Reed, in which a doctor cautioned against giving people a traumatic brain injury, TBI diagnosis, because he said it would be unsettling to them. You know, it would be depressing and it would cause them to feel that some of the symptoms that they had that were undoubtedly psychological, you know, would come to bear more heavily on them. And this paper I know of, I've read it myself, but it was also quoted to me endlessly by every single neurologist I met in anger and frustration. So I think that just the unclarity of the condition, the unclarity of the symptoms, the striking overlap with PTSD meant that people were just slow to get organized into focusing on this as a separate condition. And this is, again, where I feel that had people looked back over their shoulder a bit, looked back at the shell shock archives and data, it might have there wasn't anything lying in the World War I medical records that could give a solution, but it might have focused the problem more quickly than was the case.
Caroline Alexander's article in the February issue of National Geographic is called The Invisible War on the Brain. Caroline, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks to all of you listening today. We really appreciate your attention to the program. Thank you.